Okay, this sounds a little brutal. All right, hold on. We're going to go one at a time. Let's see. Joe, I already checked your mic. You're good. Can y'all hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, Bill, just say a few lines. Just say a couple, whatever. Doesn't matter what. This all gets cut out.
That's good, because I just wanted to let you know I've never liked you.
Catalina, tell me a few words.
Bill is really worried that he's going to sound stupid.
No, your mic sounds good. I mean, I can't promise you he's going to not sound stupid, but your mic sounds great.
Science is real, from the Big Bang to DNA. Science is real, from evolution to the Milky Way. I like those stories about angels, unicorns, and elves. Now I like those stories as much as anybody else. But when I'm seeking knowledge, either simple or abstract.
Because you guys have a pretty full playlist that you want to talk about, and I thought it was pretty exciting. So we're going to just dispense with quick takes today. Just tell us, like, the science you guys think is fun or exciting, either what you guys work on or whatever. And then from there, we'll transition into this fucking crazy Kenneth Dodd letter. I don't know who's the guy that Vogt? How do you say it? Richard Vogt?
I think it's usually Vogt.
Vogt, Richard Vogt. I don't know anything about that guy, but I have questions and things to say. But this fucking Kenneth Dodd letter, bonkers.
Isn't it amazing?
It's amazing. I thought it was The Onion for like the first page. I'm like, all right, you got some points, I guess. And the second page, I'm like, oh, this is getting real passive aggressive. And then by the third page, I'm like, what is happening?
That is literally the same reaction. Everyone who's seen this had the same thing. They're like, first page, and then they're like, oh shit, okay.
Oh fuck, we already brought it up. Let's just get into it because I can't fucking wait to talk about this. All right, so we're fucking here. It's Tuesday evenings. We got two guests today. We got Bill and Catalina. Both of them are research biologists. They're here to talk to us about science. Science they think is exciting, and science that they do. We're going to talk first about this crazy Me Too moment that happened in their world. All right, okay, so let's get started. So, Catalina, Catalina or Bill, I'll throw this out to you guys. Who wants to introduce this crazy letter from Kenneth Dodd Jr. in response to the Richard Vogt controversy, which made it all the way to, I think even the Vox I saw covered this. So this hit, this blipped at least on the national consciousness for at least a moment. I don't know. I'm going to let you guys take it from here.
I think Bill should introduce it just because he's in that actual society. So I think he has more of an insider scoop on it, but I'm happy to chime in with whatever.
This was at a conference of the joint meeting of ichthyologists and herpetologists, right? So people who study fish and amphibians and reptiles. And every year in the summer, you know, big 5-day conference, pretty standard academic communities, and everybody gets talks, you get to network, talk to students, talk to faculty members, talk to potential bosses, all that stuff. And this organization in particular does this Lifetime Achievement Award. And they break it down for, you know, best teaching, best research, best fish person, best not fish person. And the guy who won the Distinguished Herpetology Award, Vogt, he has had a bit of a reputation for including in his talks photos of students who are a little more scantily clad. And on top of that, he often has some kind of comment that goes along with it. I've seen one instance where the comment was, and the view's not so bad either, which is just, right? Like that's the, and so the thing is that like when you're doing field work and you're doing field work in rivers and swamps and stuff, you know, a lot of people tend to dress a little bit more down because those are clothes you're going to ruin. It's hot out. You're in the water. Like, so yeah, you know, shorts and a tank top for guys, oftentimes shorts and bikini tops or tank tops for girls. That's just sort of, you know, you dress comfort and functionality. He included these images in his talk and someone, it's unclear who, they think the audiovisual company running the conference went and censored some of his slides. So put these little blue boxes over images of some of his female students. He was unaware of this. He continued to go on with his talk, and he made a couple of comments when those slides came up, like, oh, I didn't put those there. It ended up being a big social media thing. So a couple of people put stuff out on Twitter. People who had walked out, who saw the images, said, this is not for me, got up and walked out. So naturally, you know, Twitter being Twitter, people got a hold of it. It started spreading. Reporters and journalists covered it. It's in the New York Times. And it started this obviously way too late discussion in herpetology and ichthyology, like what's appropriate for conferences. You know, if you ask a student to supply a photo and they supply a photo, or are you taking photos without their permission? There's a lot of these conversations going on. What's appropriate? What's not appropriate? Particularly in herpetology, which is still very much old white guys. So there's 1,000 of them. As a bearding, getting older white guy, you couldn't pick me out of this crowd to save your life.
I want to say that when I was reading the New York Times article, they said that to be a herpetologist, you needed to have a beard and wear socks with sandals. And then I understood your career so much better.
I am. So once you get to be full professor, you get to wear the socks with the sandals. It's sort of you got to work your way up to it.
Oh, sidebar. I have been rocking socks and sandals all summer, but I have been doing it with like polka dot socks, striped socks, and turquoise sandals. I'm trying to bring it back to socks and sandals, make it a thing.
That's fine.
A noble cause.
It hasn't worked. It has not worked.
It won't, I don't think it's going to.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I'm a straight dude in America. Can only fail up.
That's a good point.
All right, well, I want to pause there because we'll talk about the letter in a second. I Catalina and Joe, I assume you read the links that Bill sent us.
Yes.
Well, what are your takes? What do you think about all this? Well, we'll start with you, Joe, and then we'll let Catalina have the last.
Well, I kind of had a question from what I've read about it. Have any of the girls who were in the photos commented on this?
None that I'm aware of. This is work that was done in Brazil. Okay. And a lot of them have not had the opportunity either because they can't be reached or they weren't at the meeting.
Okay. That was my biggest thing. Like, we'll get into this letter. but just, this is a world I don't really, I'm not any part of. So I'm just kind of like sitting back and want to hear what you guys have to say, honestly.
All right, Catalina, that brings us to you. I think it's fair to say that leave me and Joe are definitely the most interested in your take on this.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so that's a lot of pressure.
You speak for all women right now.
Yeah, all women in science. So whatever I say is going to have a huge impact on everybody's career.
Not to spoil, but apparently there's only like 5 women in science anyway. So
yeah, actually, like one just died in the last 10 years. So it's So it's just me and 3 others. This is definitely, you know, a problem that exists. I don't actually even think it's about the image that was shown during the presentation so much that this guy had a record of repeatedly doing this shit in person and in presentations, and he was receiving like a lifetime achievement award. Like, we're rewarding these people for what they're doing. And the problem is, well, you said we'll get into the letter.
Oh, you can get into it now.
You know, the guy makes the point that we shouldn't be evaluating his personality, but we should be evaluating his science. But the problem with that is he is having a huge impact on other scientists' careers, right? He's effectively pushing other scientists out of science, potentially. Like, if you're a young female scientist, and you see this shit at a conference, you're like, oh, so this is what I'm getting myself into? This is how I'm going to be taken? Like, I'm never going to be taken seriously as a scientist. I'm just going to be paraded as some object on some dude's presentation. Like, you know, like it actually does have an impact on science. And yeah, sure. In the ideal world, in the perfect meritocracy, sure. We should be evaluating people on their science and not on their personalities, but those two are not two separate things. So I think whatever that guy wrote from when he said we should only be looking at his contributions to science, like, I was like, okay, bullshit, done.
You made that's a great point, what you just said about giving this person a lifetime achievement award, right? This is not like James Gunn, whose career and his name has been driven through the mud, or somebody of that, right? This is just an award. Right? He's still going to be able to do his research. His life will be largely unaffected, other than his name tarnished, you know, for things that he did, right? I think that in that sense right there, what you just said, that the letter, which we'll get to if we keep dancing around it, said that people were waiting for an opportunity to strike. It is a sort of character assassination language. But at the same time, if this guy is putting up pictures of women in their bikinis and cracking jokes, like you said, Bill, you have to wear, you know, appropriate clothing for being out in the hot, right? But you don't have to choose those pictures, right? There's nothing says that you have to have this image of this woman, right? Regardless of whether or not she is on board or not. Like, Joe, you brought up that anybody asked for permission, the letter said something similar.
Yeah.
But this is a organization of professionals, and I get, like, yeah, even in a professional atmosphere, we're allowed to have a little fun. I mean, this is me, after all, right? But at the same time, like, I can't imagine any scenario in any other discipline where I can just have, you know, a pair of tits on the screen and be like, huh? Am I right, fellas? Like, where people would just look the other way. Like, I can't think, I just can't imagine a scenario in any field, I'm in the humanity side of things, where that would be met with anything other than, at the very least, chagrin. But what I'm getting is that this has been just looked at side-eye for decades, if at all.
So I would say this definitely, in the sciences, like, people put photos up from field work, and yeah, they're relevant, right? I mean, it's showing what you're doing in field work. But yeah, you can choose wisely. And I really like what you kind of pointed out. It's like, when you're doing that, you're talking to the other dudes, right? Yeah. Like, am I right, fellas? You're just looking over the females in the audience, or whoever else might be in the audience. You're just looking at the good old boys and being like, we're in this club. This photo is for you guys. We know what we're talking about.
People always say women don't want to understand. And I was like, man, if every time I went to a conference, I had to see somebody just have one funny picture of a sombrero and be like, hey, verdad? What ale? I'll be like, all right, I'm not doing this.
Well, and especially if you're, right, and we can talk about the STEM thing, because I've been a little outspoken. I think it's not an issue of getting the people into STEM. It's getting them to stay. And part of that's exactly that, right? If you don't feel like you're welcome in the community, then you're not going to stay in the community. It's not like we do it for the pay and the glory and fame, right? It's because you dig what you do. And I know, Carolina, if I speak for you, feel free to smack me.
Please do speak for me. You're my husband. After all.
If I'm including photos of my students in a talk, first thing is I'll ask them, like, hey, do you have a photo that I can include in this talk? It is going to be seen by a bunch of professionals, you know, people who work in the field. It could be photos of work-related stuff, or it could just be a headshot they want to use. But I first make them give me a photo, and then the caveat is I am going to be showing this on a screen to hopefully 100, 150 people, probably like 12. But there might be a large group of people here. If you're okay with this, go.
I was going to say, so is he the only bad actor, or is how prevalent is this?
It's occasional, I would say. Okay. It's not, well, I am really lucky. I'm in a society that has a really good representation of women. Even like the presidents and past presidents of the society have been women, both of the societies that I'm in. And so it's not that bad, but when I look around, I hear like the stories from the bigger conferences. It happens, I with some regularity, I guess. Wouldn't you say, Bill?
I would say I don't want to generalize, but the people, you know, if you're doing field work, the opportunity for that exists more, right? If you're doing a bunch of genetics work in a lab, you might not have photos like this. Whereas, you know, if you're doing tropical you know, sea snake research, you probably have more of those photos. I know that the shark people had a big problem with it for a while because most of them are doing a lot of field work. A lot of them are out in boats or doing tropical settings. And so they tend to, they had this problem a little bit more. They came down on it, I think about 2 years ago. And the bigger organization that I belong to only put a code of conduct in within the last 2 years. So it's been an issue long enough that people are finally starting to do something about it, but it does feel a little late.
Yeah.
I guess it's better late than never. You keep saying things like shark people and fish people, and I feel like it doesn't mean what I want it to mean.
Sometimes it does.
I want to approach this via analogy by something that happened a few months back that I think got swept under the rug, and I'll say when I was looking into this, so I looked into just very cursory, I looked into Professor Vogt, and he's been doing science. That's how you say it, right? Doing science.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's for 50 years. Something like 50 years, right? So this man is probably in his 70s, 80s, right?
Yep.
And not to excuse that, and I've never met this individual. If he's still researching, he's obviously still, you know, still feeling it, still out there. I can't imagine myself being 80 and doing any kind of field work or even yard work. But I thought of an analogy. This is just what came into my head, and maybe this is a false connection, but I thought about the Stan Lee story that came out 6 months ago. Did you guys catch this? That his nurses were all pissed off at him because he was basically, you know, he was ass-grabbing and, you know, whatever. And, of course, he's almost 100 years old, right? He's in a nursing home. Or, no, he's not a nursing home. He has private nurses, but essentially he's turned his house into a nursing home. And he caught a lot of flack for being a grab-asser, right? And I thought two things. First, I thought, like, yeah, he's from that generation. I'm not surprised. And I don't know if that's jaded. I will admit that I love Stan Lee, so I was a little bit wanting to find excuses for him. I admit that openly, even though I know it's not fair. But I also thought, and I just want this for your opinion, and maybe I'm off base, and I don't know how much this applies to Mr. Vogt, but I also thought that he's 96, which means he's been an old man for 20 years, right? And the way we treat old people in this country is very infantilizing. And I think for a long time, the old lecherous man has been something that has been sort of smirked at in a, I don't want to say a loving way, but definitely not in a condemning way. I think of, like, even characters in popular culture. The first thing I thought of was Mr. Roshi from Dragon Ball Z, right? The sort of ass-grabby old man. And now I'm like, well, of course, we can't have that. Like, we should have had that. It's about time we got rid of that. Right, there's a lot of it's about time stuff happening in the last 5 years or so. But I also thought if he's been sort of, I won't say praised, but chuckled at for 20 years for being this behavior and suddenly it's not okay, to what extent do we have to consider any potential ageism in this? Maybe not at all. Mr. Vogt, he's probably in his 80s. This seems like a minor offense compared to his previous offenses. Not on its own, obviously unacceptable. But I wonder to what extent do we factor age into this? And this is going to be a hilariously appropriately gendered phrase, but to what extent are people grandfathered into, all right, we're just going to have to wait for your age to die off? Or do we intervene and have no exceptions? And I ask that genuinely, not really knowing which one I think is fair, but I also, and it's not up to me. It's just something I'm struggling with, I guess. And does that apply here? I don't know.
Can I take this one?
Please.
I think that it can be graded on a curve a little bit. Like, I guess that's what you're suggesting, right? That, you know, some, I think what should be counted into the curve, however, is the power dynamic. Like, how much power does this individual wield over other people?
Oh, that's and a good point.
If they are wielding a lot of power, then screw them and screw their, like, cute old man act. I don't care.
Oh, snap. All right. I don't have a follow up. Bill, you got something for that?
I was going to say there seems to be a pattern, at least, that we keep trying to distinguish that, right? Like, people against gay marriage was, well, that generation is going to go away and then we'll all accept it. And if anything, in the last couple of years, we kept saying that about racism. Like, oh, it's just an old white guy. Of course he's scared of other races. And then, especially, you know, those last two have not gone away. So I don't think if you let that slide, if this individual is still teaching other people that that's an okay way to behave, then it's not going to necessarily age out.
Kylie, I can go back to your point about power. That's a great point, because even the thing I said about ageism usually applies to people who are essentially rendered powerless, usually by circumstance or economics. That doesn't seem to apply at all to the two people I brought up. So to go back to something me and Joe have said in the past, fuck them. GTFOH, right? Get the fuck out of here.
Science is real, from anatomy to geology. Science is real, from astrophysics to biology.
And with that, let's get to this crazy town letter. This letter is insane. Can I please be the one to introduce it?
I want to say one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to steal a little bit of thunder.
Hit it.
This is a life tip for me. If at any point you type the phrase crotch grabbing shorts, stop. Done.
And if you're going to use it, don't put your letterhead on top of it. What the fuck is going on with this letter? All right, so we're going to go in this order. I'm going to just present what's happening in this letter. I want Joe's reactions first, Bill and Catalina. You can have the sort of last word. I don't know. We're probably going to talk about this for a while because this shit is fucking bananas. So the former president of the Herpetology League, which on Twitter is at Herp League, which I just can't stop giggling at because I'm a child. A former president, we'll call him Ken. I don't think I might have said his name earlier. I probably shouldn't have. Ah, fuck him. He posted it. Fucking President Ken Dodd. He sent out an email in response to vote getting his Lifetime Achievement Award. It's a Lifetime Achievement Award, right?
Yep.
Yep.
And it opens with sort of disappointment that it happened because of a Twitter outrage. And it's four pages. And then the fourth page is like the credits, because it's just like the end of the email chain. The first one is questioning how the media, he made some legitimate questions about the story out of media and interviews and how much of this is appropriate. Which I was like, okay, fair enough. And I think Bill, we said earlier that like he starts off like, okay, you're making some points. All right, I'm hearing you.
His tone is still very condescending in that first page.
Oh, super, yeah. super duper. But there's a part of me that I was like, okay, this is a probably full professor somewhere. They can't turn that off. And then the second page starts turning into this like, if women didn't want their pictures taken, why are you wearing crotch grabbing shorts? Kind of blame the woman type thing. Kids these days, there's a little bit of that in there. I'm going to be like, I wish I'd picked out my favorite lines. And then the third page turns into like this weird good old boy tone that ends with like the weirdest version of I have black friends, so I'm not racist. And that is my wife got her ass beat, so I think I know what I'm talking about. What the fuck? I just didn't see that coming. And he closed with that. That was his closing argument. By the way, I married a woman who was abused by a man, so I think I know. Like, what the fuck? I thought for real this was an onion thing forever. Like, for like 15 minutes, I was looking around like, no. This is a prank. This is not real. But I have not turned up any evidence that this dude, and I'm just going to say it, lives in Florida. All of this. So, Joe, we'll start with you, man. What were your takes on an open letter to the members of the Herpetologist League?
I wish I could have been there and typed this angrily at night to see the look of how proud he was when he was done and he hit send and he was just like, that'll show him. That I just wish I was there for that. What a fucking
Do you think he proofread it, or do you think he was like, gold, send?
No,
this is an email. This is an email sent, and you can see at the top, like, all the different, like, people he CC'd. Like, he went through and he clicked. Do you think he went through his address box and just clicked individual names, or just, like, every name? Like, I wonder, I'm with you. I want to know the process of this.
This went to everybody in the league. So everybody that's an official member of the organization got this email.
Yeah. This, what a guy. What did you think, Bill?
I feel like when he got hit up, just his pants, and then walked off smugly. Like, just kind of that.
What bougie-ass thing do you think he was drinking? Is this a Scotch letter, or is this like a Bernays letter?
Ooh.
Like, what's he swirling in his former president of the Herpetologist League, which he made sure we knew multiple times, in his Herpetologist of the Year mug, what's he drinking?
He's got to be scotch.
Think so? I was hoping it's got to be. I was hoping it was red wine. There's a wine drunk tone to this. All right, so I want to read a couple passages, and you guys can just respond as you like. This is at the bottom of page one. Then I began to wonder about the media campaign. It was all so slick, well-planned. I have dealt with the national media on a national basis. Humble brag. And something was not right here. Quite frankly, the writing and reporting were terrible. It made me, that idea that, like, this sort of so slick, so well planned. How high are the stakes in the Herpetologist League? Like, how long was the New York Times waiting in the weeds? Oh, that metaphor really works here, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And then he goes into this sort of, like, hashtag face news section with some genuine, like, interesting questions. Like, I don't want to play devil's advocate. I like to call it angel's adversary. He said, why do certain Americans think they have the right to dictate to women of other cultures what should be won in the field during research? Why were the women not interviewed? Are Brazilian women capable of speaking for themselves? And at first I was like, that's a good point. And then I thought, did you?
And I doubt he's ever met or spoken with any of them. This is again, it's based on the photos and how people present themselves in the photos.
Right, right. Like, if you didn't want, it's almost like it's the oldest fucking, oh man, it's the oldest thing in the book, right? If she didn't want her picture taken, why was she wearing a bikini, right? There may not be a need for an official dress code, but some of our colleagues, particularly young women, need to reassess attire. Particularly young women. Like, there it is. There's so many versions of that in here. This is not appropriate attire for a professional scientific society meeting. Like, meeting? I don't think they showed up to the conference in their bikinis. They showed up to the beach in their bikinis, and old man Vogt took their pictures and showed all his friends.
Well, and also there's this thing that he's, the tone is as if it was about the photos, and somehow the audience was, like, offended by seeing the photos, like, seeing women in bikinis. Like, the audience wasn't offended. Like, nobody was offended by seeing women in bikinis. Everybody was outraged by this sleazy old man putting pictures of his, like, students or field assistants in his presentation. Like, is he missing the point deliberately on this? It's just ridiculous.
I don't think he does, because he has this passage in the second page. I have read this thing multiple times. Like, I might perform it as, like as, like, spoken word, like, as a slam poem. In effect, this episode was not about Dr. Vogt's behavior or lecture at the JMIH in Rochester. So he knows. He knows that's not what it's about. It was about his past, which does include the use of questionable photos. Parentheses, my opinion. Who knows? Like, no, that's not your opinion. That's everyone's opinion. That's why we're here. And his unconventional behavior. Translate, he says what's on his mind, so you definitely don't have to guess. And then I'm like, I kind of don't want to have to guess. I want you to tell me. If you have to allude to the things he says, as opposed to just fucking saying them, you know that's out of bounds. Like, you know. Indeed, Dr. Rosenberg admits this in July 22nd email, and he quotes him. Of course, he doesn't mind quoting him. But then he continues for a page and a half on this crazy diet. And here's where I said it starts getting a little like kids these days. He has this tirade on flip-flops. Is that a conversation you guys have? Let's talk about flip-flops. When and when are not flip-flops appropriate in professional settings? That this needs to be a point made in this letter.
Here's my hot take. I hate flip-flops.
Here's my Here's my hot take. After this letter, I wore flip-flops for the entire conference.
Fuck yeah.
Including giving my poster presentation, including, like, all the professional conversations that I had. I was just like, flip-flops are fucking comfortable, and I'm going to wear them. And they go with my outfit, and I just, whatever. Yeah. This is my outfit now.
I'm glad he didn't mention that flip-flops technically have a thong, that little piece that goes in between your toes. It's called the thong. Let's see. Here it is. And right after that, if you want to be treated like professional scientists, act like one. Who the fuck is that for?
Well, so here's the thing. You go to these conferences, and you can tell who's new because they've got, you know, the guys are wearing shirts and ties. Like, everybody who's – this is their first big conference. They're all really dressed up. You know who's wearing mud-stained shorts and T-shirts that are, like, ripped with blood and who knows what else on them?
You.
Well, me, yes. I don't like the shorts, but yeah, there's a lot of blood on my shirts when I go.
Right. Let's see. He keeps going. This is what should and probably won't happen. As Dr. Joe Mitchell, former president, notes, HL seems to be a CYA model. I don't know what CYA means. Do you guys know what that
Cover
means?
Cover your ass.
Blah. That's literally what they were doing, was covering asses in these pictures, Mr. Dodd. The person who authorized this fiasco should be identified and reprimanded. I feel like that's what happened.
Yeah, isn't that exactly
isn't
what the
that
person...
how this turned out? Yeah. Let's see if there was indeed a setup, as I suspect. Oh, this is what I was thinking. Like, is this the MAGA guy? This is getting real fake newsy. Like, I wanted to end with like witch hunt. Yeah.
Oh God.
But then he has this weird anti-MAGA comment at the end, which was truly totally surprised me. But anyway. And then he wants a word to be given back. Let's see. And then this is the part where I think where Joe's right, where he must be like, oh, because his last sentence is respectfully submitted. Oh my God. One last thing. In my defense, I'm sure some will be upset with these comments. Okay, here it is. I have mentored a number of female grad students. So I think I can talk about the ladies. I have been the professor.
Yeah.
I've met a lady. I can say
that. I married a lady.
Yeah.
I'm legally allowed to speak for her. I have also had South Asian, Chinese American, and Bulgarian male grad students. Like, okay. I don't see how that applies. The Bulgarian one really surprised
Bulgarian.
Me. Yeah, the Bulgarian. Yeah,
that reeks of somebody having a bad experience right there. I even mentored a Bulgarian once.
Yeah. Let's see. I nominated the first woman president of the HL. Anyone can nomination. Why haven't you? So here we go, right? But here's the bit. Okay, here's the one. Is this? Yes. Okay, I have to read this verbatim. This is like a poem. This sentence. I know the difference between cardboard social media outrage and real terror. My wife was the victim of horrific domestic violence in previous marriage. Now I want to pause here. I am not making fun of his wife. Like, that fucking sucks. Obviously. I am making fun of you for deploying it to defend some pervy old man's pictures of young ladies. So, let's make it 100% clear. Kenneth Dodd, I am absolutely making fun of you. I know more than I hope any of you ever will the emotional, spiritual, physical damage, sexual harassment, and assault can bring. I really hope his wife's not copied on this. Because, like, I have a feeling you don't know as much as she does.
A scientific theory isn't just a hunch or guess, it's more like a question. It's been put through a lot of tests, and when a theory emerges consistent with the facts, the proof is with science, the truth is with science.
We touched on this earlier. STEM, I'll open with a anecdote from a friend of mine to sort of talk about this. We want to talk about the idea that STEM is a meritocracy, right? Humanities, which is the world that I live in, is often lambasted for being ultimately nothing but a bunch of identity politics. And, you know, not to branch off into that, that's not unfounded, but is often weaponized in a way that misses the point. In very much the same way that Dodd's letter opens with weaponizing a truth and then applying it to something outside of the scope of that truth, right? But STEM has always been talked about as a meritocracy, right? Only the best rise at the top. And I have a friend who's a chemist, right? And one of the things he always jokes about with me when I talk about my own pitfalls and travails through this world is, he always says, "That's why I love atoms. They have no politics." But he is now in a place of despair because his son is super maggot out. And he's like, "How did this happen?" And I'm like, "I have a feeling I know how it happened." You know? So, what do you think about that notion? The idea that STEM, you know, whether it be academia, undergrads, or the private sector, how do you feel about the idea of this is a meritocracy?
Well, I think that's kind of what we were told, like we got into it, and that was part of why it was so appealing to those of us that felt, you know, excited about pursuing our passion and, you know, going into science. And it was kind of like, you're just being judged based on what you can do or what you achieve or the ideas that you have. And then, of course, you find out that that shit is really, really hard. And it's, in fact, so hard that you can be really good and still fail. And so I think the people who do make it to, like, who make it, like, to the top and make it to academic positions and are successful, they don't like hearing, and obviously this is not just STEM, right? I mean, they don't like hearing that they had an advantage by being white and being dudes or whatever, because they feel like it negates the hard work that they've done. But the fact is, like, you can still work, you can work really, really hard and you have to work really, really hard and be really lucky to get, you know, to achieve success in STEM. And I think it's just hard to hear that, oh yeah, you got here by hard work, but also by privilege. But that is what it is, because there's the opportunities that you have to have. And Bill's going to, I'm sure, have a lot of good things to say about that. But, like, the way you have to prove yourself and, you know, the sacrifices that you have to make, not everybody's able to make them. Like, I was definitely really lucky by entering grad school with, you know, no student debt, because I got my undergrad elsewhere and, you know, in a system that's not quite so fucked up as here. And so I started without this giant handicap, and I made a bunch of sacrifices to take unpaid opportunities or to work extra, but not everybody can, right? Some of our students have to work, can't take an unpaid internship or can't take, like, a shitty paid research opportunity because they got to work to afford things in life.
Can I ask a follow-up? Actually, since you alluded to it, and I don't think our listeners would know this because they don't know you like I know you, but you're an immigrant, right?
Yes.
So to what extent has the immigration experience, I guess, intersected with this conversation?
Well, I think I, you know, like I said, I feel like I was really lucky because I didn't enter the field, the playing field, with a, you know, thousands of dollars of money owed to somebody. But on the other hand, it also, you know, being an immigrant is hard, especially having, like, a really funny name when you're applying to places, and that's what people read first. But also, you know, dealing with paperwork, knowing that not everybody wants to sponsor a visa when you're applying for a job or a postdoc or something like that. Like, yeah, there's handicaps. I can be really good, but then when it comes to weighing me against a candidate that doesn't come with all that baggage or all that extra paperwork or whatever I imagine many employers go towards the candidate that's easier to handle, if you will.
I like the way you phrase that, because when I talk about white privilege with my students, I actually think that the phrase white privilege, I think, is actually kind of misleading. And just for all cards on the table, me and Bill, we used to be roommates in college, and, you know, we're both working class kids, so we talk about this a lot of the time. white privilege implies freedom from obstacles or freedom from challenges. Obviously, that's not true. Life doesn't see color. Life is coming for us all, right? None of us got to get out of this shit alive. But when you are straight, white, and male, right? And myself, I have two of those, right? So there are times where I'm like, whew, like, I know I got out of that because I'm a dude. Like, I know it, you know? It isn't that you have no challenges. It is that you're not asked to face certain obstacles. Some of those obstacles are logistical, like having to deal with a visa application or get a green card. Some of those are more social, like having to deal with the police. Bill was there the first time. He said, like, I've never had a policeman talk to me that way before. And I've always said, I've never had one not talk to me that way before. And stuff like that, right? So it isn't that they are living charmed lives. Unless you're also rich, then you probably are living a charmed life. But being white doesn't being white, being male, being straight doesn't exclude you from tragedy, from trauma, from challenges. It does prevent you from having to deal from some very specific things that can very easily derail you.
And that other people take for granted not having to deal with, right? Like, most people don't even, well, white people don't even think about most of the time dealing with the police.
Right.
Or, you know, non-immigrants don't never think about, like, oh, why shouldn't I apply for this job? Or, you know, why could I face obstacles applying for this job? So, anyway, it's hard to explain.
Or something as simple as, why shouldn't I tell my parents who I'm dating?
Well, and to go back to the conference, right? If I walk into the conference room, at least half, and at this particular one this summer, more, look just like me. No one's stopping to look at me or something like that. I'm yet another bearded white guy walking in a room full of bearded white guys. So there's inherently like a sense of community in that.
I was going to say, it's like a Newport Folk Festival.
It's exactly what it is.
Hey, I love the Newport Folk Festival. I ain't trying to cast shade.
You probably wouldn't even know I was there because I looked like everyone else there.
Wait, I thought you were the lead singer of Fleet Foxes.
I thought we weren't identifying ourselves.
Oh, sorry. Oh, my bad. Joe, you got a take?
Well, it's different for me because I'm sort of racially ambiguous. And so people know I'm not one of them, but they're never really quite sure what I am. So that sort of has its advantages, especially when you work in my particular industry, which is sales. And I sell to all sort of cultures. So most cultures accept me because they'll either immediately assume I'm one of them or they'll just assume I'm safe. And that safeness mostly comes from I'm very, very light skinned. There's a comfort people have with that. So I'm also invited into white spaces. Most black people aren't because they don't immediately assume I'm black. So it's definitely been helpful in my career in sales. Me personally, like going back to where we're talking about in the sciences, and just like what you guys have had to go through, like in your careers. Shit, I'm high. I lost my point.
All right, well, fuck it. We're moving on. All right. Those who are. Did anybody have a last thought they wanted to add to that? Because I really want to hear about what science is exciting you right now. I don't know if every. I almost feel like it's a show and tell. I got to play today and a bunch of science blogs, and I picked out the story I want to talk about. But did anyone want to add? Did anything go unsaid in the last conversation?
I do think that one thing that I didn't realize till I got where I am is, in addition to the luck stuff that Carolina said, there are little biases all over the place that you don't realize till you're trying to get that job or you're trying to do something else. So, you know, the money's the big one, right? Not being able to get that experience so that when you're trying to get the good grad position later, you're like, oh, you could have done this internship. I don't have $3,000 over the summer. Like, I gotta do something. But even little things like what you work on can influence the kind of the job you get. So I happen to work on an animal, my current research being snakes. Most people, even if they hate snakes, they want to hear about them. They're like, okay, what? That seems weird. Why would you do that? But I automatically have your interest. Whereas if you do the exact kind of research I do, but you do it on, you know, something very small or something that people don't inherently have feelings about, it's harder to gain their interest. And then it's harder to, let's say, if you're interviewing for a job, how do you sell yourself to the audience if people immediately don't care about what you do? And that was not something I realized till when I was doing my master's, I worked on these little tadpoles, and it very quickly became clear that no one gave a shit because they were tiny little tadpoles and who cares.
Story of my life, man.
Yeah, right? Like, I'm preaching to the choir on that one, but it's like, you know, if I show up to a conference and I say, hey, I'm just going to play videos of snakes biting things, I will have 100 people show up. Whereas if I say, oh, I've developed this new technique for curing cancer and fixing these other diseases, but it works in these tiny little things, 5 people will show up. Hmm. And so there's like these weird little biases that until you're deep into it, you don't necessarily know. And then that allocates how people get funding, that allocates how you pick up graduate students, that allocates the kind of position you get. Like, all those little things suddenly start adding up.
It's interesting how much economics makes your choices in grad school when you think about what you're going to have expertise in, right? For me, so I do, you know, minority literatures, right? Asian American and Latino being the big ones. I've branched out into comic books recently, but there was this, you sort of know, unless they just tell you, and sometimes it happens from both sides of this color spectrum, from people of color to people that aren't of color. A Latino man teaching Latino literature in a industry that is underrepresented in Latinos, underrepresented in men, strangely enough. So I'm this sort of what's that show, 30 Rock? I'm a twofer. I'm a dude and I'm a person of color. And like, Joe, I'm light-skinned, so it's like, I'm a person of color in a way that isn't going to offend nobody, right? But, and I'm very much aware of that. I'm very much aware of my color privilege, particularly in my community, which is very colorist. Like, Latinos, we gotta be better. But, so there's this idea that, oh yeah, they're gonna get the brown guy to teach the brown things. Had I chosen Victorian literature, they're not looking at me. There are no Asian people teaching Renaissance. Like, we are expected to stay in our lanes. And it's this weird, I don't want to say separate equal, but I can't think of anything else. White people will occasionally get brown literature jobs, but usually it's because the brown people are all been snapped up, right? Because there's not that many of us, right? But I've never met like a black Victorianist. You know, it's just, it's weird. And we choose those, not because there's a rule against it, because that I know. I had a person of color once tell me about a fellow student who was trying to study British literature, who was an Asian woman, say like, she needs to find a way to get some Asian stuff in there. She's not getting hired.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
I can't say it surprises me. I'm just like, yep, that sounds great. When theory emerges consistent with the facts, the proof is with science, the truth is with science. Science is real.
So let's the bummer the part of the meat of this sandwich, the bummer part of the meat is taken care of. Let's get to the good stuff. I want to hear about what kind of science is exciting you right now, like what either that you're working on or something that you've read about. I don't care how weird or esoteric it is. In fact, the weirder and more esoteric, the better. Like, bring it. What you guys got? I don't know if, Joe, you looked up anything for this. I don't know if you're just reacting, but I found one thing that is just, I found two things actually that I thought were just super fun, but I don't want to start with mine. Like, what you guys got?
Okay, you want me to go first? Well, I got a lot though, because I just came back from this conference that was super inspiring. Yeah, and it was in Vancouver, which was awesome.
How's Vancouver?
Oh my God, everybody should move there right now. It's awesome. It's the best place ever. I hope you cut this out, but hear me out. Clothing optional beaches and legal weed. Just go there and do your thing. It's going to be awesome.
Well, I live in Massachusetts, and so also, I got one of those.
Yeah, but you can have both on the West Coast where the winters aren't so harsh. Oof. So, but also this conference, which was really great. And I loved it. It was a joint conference. And if you want weird and esoteric, It was the Joint Conference of the Phycological Society of America, not to be confused with psychological. Phycological means people who like algae, which is like seaweeds and pond scum type of stuff. And the other society that met with us was the International Society of Protistologists, not to be confused with proctologists. Protistologists are the people who study tiny little eukaryotic microbes. So not bacteria, but like other microscopic things.
I'm nodding ahead like I understand like that.
Like malaria. Like some of them are parasites that cause malaria or sleeping sickness. But just like a bunch of shit that's like in the water and in the soil, amoebas, that sort of stuff. So anyway, it was really awesome. And it was just like crazy science. Some of the stuff that really excites me, I think the most exciting talk was on how climate change, well, it was part of the talk, how climate change impacts the seaweed harvest by the native communities around Vancouver. So they're, you know, the native people, First Nations, and a lot of their culture is built around harvesting seaweeds, and not just for food, but also to like make stuff out of. And climate change is impacting that in many ways, but like impacting the harvest times and whatever. So there was like this ethnobotany window into a culture that I had no idea about. And it was like a little bit of science, a little bit of culture, a little bit of, you know, social justice. It was just fantastic. So I just want to say Nancy Turner was, you know, the speaker. If you want to check out her work, I would recommend everybody do that. She brought snacks, seaweed snacks, to the talk. So you can't really beat that. The other, so that's not really that esoteric, but it's awesome because it's like, because it's awesome. The other super esoteric and weird science that excites me is this project that I'm hoping to work on with a colleague of mine. And she studies, how should I explain this?
As raunchily as possible. Use as many F words as you can.
So she studies soil crusts. So if you think of a desert, you guys are from Texas, not from the desert part of it.
No, the swamp. No.
Okay. Okay, so the other side of Texas has a bunch of desert, I think. I don't know. But, like, if you keep going past El Paso, you get to Las Cruces, which is my friend, where my friend Nicole's reigns over soils in the desert. And so she studies these soil crusts, which are assemblages of microbial things that hold the top layer of the soil together, which is really important because if you don't have that, you can get like dust storms and shit, like an erosion and like a bunch of bad stuff happens. So anyway, so these crusts are important, but they have really cool algae growing in there. And so we started talking about and started applying for grants to study the algae and the cyanobacteria in these soil crusts. And because we've already described a bunch of new species from there, they're really understudied. And her particular thing now is studying the gypsum crusts, which are chemically really different. So if you know the White Sands, what's it called? National Monument? Yeah, White Sands. It's gypsum dunes, basically White Sands, because they're gypsum based. And so the algae from there have not been studied, and we're going to go in there and we're going to study them. It's going to be awesome. And I'm really excited about that. And that's like, that's it. That's as weird and esoteric as you can get.
I have two follow-up questions. Number one.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask them both, and you can answer them in any order you want, or you can just ignore them. The first one, going back to the seaweed harvest in Vancouver for the native peoples, the indigenous peoples. So what was found, like, is I keep waiting to hear that somebody's benefiting from climate change, and I want to believe it would be the Inuit people, if anybody. But if not, I mean, whatever. I just, I'm curious what that found. And number two, since this is an algae, I guess not an algae conference, but some algae presentations. Were there any suspicious individuals in trench coats that you suspected might be like three krill on each other's shoulders to find out about algae?
Okay, so first question, the effects of climate change are not good. They're mostly bad.
Damn it.
It's mostly there's more cloud cover. The one thing that I remember is there's more cloud cover now. So, and they're traditionally their harvest is on sunny days. So they now have fewer days to harvest. But I think I mean, it might be just a matter of time to, because yeah, if it's getting warmer, there might be new opportunities, new species of seaweed moving in. So, I mean, it's, there might be some cultural changes coming with that, but for now, it's not good. Sorry. And the other question is, no, there were no like, amoebas or krill in trench coats, but maybe that could be a thing for the next time we meet with the protistologist. Like we had a really cool, trivia night, which my team didn't do so well in. We were doing really good after round one and we bombed it as everybody started drinking.
What was your team name?
Oh, good question. We had the best team name from them all. Right,
pause.
They all suck.
Pause. Sidebar. Your trivia team name. Go.
Dar Winners.
Oh, God.
Yeah, no, I knew Bill would hate it. That's why I never told him before.
Bill, what's yours?
I'm still recovering from hers. I'm going to do it in a second.
I got mine. It's
what's yours?
BoJack Horseman of the Apocalypse.
Nice.
I don't even like that show. All right, Bill, what science is exciting you?
I'm doing nothing interesting. So there's that. But what's really cool right now is sometimes a lot of my work involves taking high-speed video of animals moving. And then to get useful stuff out of that, you got to, you know, like click little points on it. Like if an animal's opening its mouth, you got to hit a couple points on it. And you do that manually. So you click these points. These could be tens of thousands of frames. And it's just mind-numbing. But a group at Harvard has used machine learning to do all that stuff automatically. And so I, for one, welcome my robot overlords because it means if I never have to click another video again. So, like, you show this software, you set it all up, and you pretty much go, okay, on these five frames, you're going to do that one, that one, that one, that one. And you're going to run through those points. And I'm going to show you how to do it on a couple more, and then you're going to run with it. And the software picks it up like it's nothing. And it's insane and terrifying and amazing, because I'm pretty sure that's how they're going to use, just one of the things they're going to use to start tracking us.
Ooh. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Because once, you know, it's particularly with the lab that was doing it at Harvard, they were looking at brain development in rats and mice and how they grab things. And they showed they have a video on YouTube, and it shows how quickly the software picks up all the points on the rat's paw and is able to, okay, here's the cup, here are the digits of the hand, here are the different bones, boom, we're done. And that would have taken myself or my students maybe 2-3 weeks to do manually, and the software does it in about an hour, and that's just insanity.
Dude, going back to what you said earlier about robot overlords, one thing I read today, yeah. That there is a astrophysicist who's trying to design a system for alerting us about California wildfires sooner. And he has this whole thing where he wants to use drones and satellite imagery and stuff like that. And I was just like, oh, cool. Drones are cheap. Why not? Why aren't we doing that now? And then the bombshell, I was reading it. You know how we know there's a wildfire right now? What our system is for learning, oh, shit, California's on fire. You know what our alert system is right now?
They're like birds.
No, not even that.
Telegraph?
Close. Somebody has to call it in. Somebody has to notice that California is on fire and make a phone call. Other than that, no one's even watching is what I gleaned from this. They're like, yeah, California is always on fire. Like, what the hell? Like, that's what it takes is a phone call? Like, I have to feel like our robot overlords would at least be more efficient.
I mean, especially once they put us out of the way,
right? Did you guys see this story about the Sun probe, the Parker probe?
Yes.
That's cool. Did you hear about this? This probe they sent to the Sun, it's going to get there in 7 years, that can survive solar radiation, but can't survive the corona. For those who don't know, the corona is the layer of heated gas outside the Sun. One of the things that I learned today that's crazy about the Sun is that the atmosphere around the Sun is hotter than the Sun itself, and they don't understand why. It's called the corona. You guys heard of this? You guys know about this?
Yes.
And they don't understand why. The corona gets up to 1,000,000 degrees Fahrenheit or something, but the Sun itself is just a balmy, like 40,000 or something like that.
Yeah, it's practically
nothing. So they sent this probe out there that can survive the Sun's regular heat, but has to learn how to fly around the corona without getting burnt up by it because the corona is a million degrees. And it was named the Parker Probe after one of the first scientists to study the sun, which I think is a cool legacy for that dude.
If it makes it.
Yeah, he makes it. This dude looks like, because I saw a picture of the dude and he looks like John Hurt's grandfather, man. I don't know how much longer he has.
Yeah, but he's the first guy to study the sun. He can't be that recent, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, what do you think that is?
Yeah. I don't know. Shit, Galileo. Anyways. All right. So, final thoughts. All right. So, I want to close. We're about time to wrap up. Thanks for being here with us today. And, Bill, you had something really interesting to say on Twitter. I thought it would make a great takeaway. So, I want to ask you both this. We'll go Bill first, Carlene the second. You said you'd like to tell people, and we're hard turning back into science, telling people something that you wish you knew starting out. So why don't you start, and then Carlene, you can close.
All right. So some things I wish I knew when I had started. When everyone says it's a 60 to 80 hour work week, that can be true. For a lot of people, that is true. But for a lot of successful people, it doesn't have to be true. There are a lot of good people who can balance their time and do the whole work smarter, not harder thing. And they're totally fine. And the second thing is you don't have to be the best to be happy at what you do, right? Like, I'm not running a 30-person lab at Harvard with millions and millions of dollars of funding doing whatever I want. Like, I'm, for lots of reasons, I never made it there, so to speak. But where I'm at now, in terms of my level, like, and where my position is and everything else, is more than I could have asked for. And I probably wouldn't be happy running that giant lab, trying to manage all those people and all that money. Like, if you gave that opportunity to me now, I'd probably lose my mind. But for years, I thought I was a huge disappointment because I was never really on that track.
That's huge. That's a huge thing to say, man, because when I talk to my students that are my freshmen who are entering STEM worlds, the reputation is that it's hyper-competitive and they have to be achievers or they're losers, right? It's actually kind of a capitalist mentality, right? If you're not growing, you're dying, right? You have to always be expanding. You have to always be building. There's no conversation. I can't say there's none because I'm not in that world, but the idea of just live your best life, right, doesn't come up very often for students who are thinking about entering those worlds. And I am not in that world, so I'm like, well, you actually probably know more about what it takes to make it in those worlds than I do. I just know what classes you should take. So do this and navigate it this way. So that's actually, I think, an important thing for people to hear, that there's a way to do it that just lets you do it. You don't have to be, the president of any big society writing salty letters at 3 a.m, with your glass of Syrah.
Maybe someday. Maybe someday.
I wonder what hill you'll die on.
It's not going to be a good one. I know that. I know it's not going to be a good one. No, but this idea that and inherently you're going to be better at something that makes you happy anyway.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Carlina?
So I got two as well. One is about research, and I guess I was, and this is probably because I'm a woman in STEM, just terrified as a grad student that I would graduate and then be a professor and then never have original ideas of my own. That I was just building off of other people's ideas and I would just never have anything original to contribute. And now, of course, I'm just I have too many projects that I started that I can't possibly finish. I have too many ideas that I still want to start. So the thing that I wish I knew is it's a matter of building up this knowledge, and it's not one thing that you learn or one skill that you learn. It's building up this base of things that you know that are connected, and the more of the connections that you make, the ideas just sprout out of that. There's no shortage of that. It's going to be fine. Focus on being a well-rounded scientist, learn new things, branch out a little bit, and then the ideas will come. And the other thing is, going into a teaching job, I was really worried that I was not a good teacher, that I was never going to be a good teacher, because I always heard about, oh, so-and-so, he or she has like this gift, and they're just a really good teacher because that's who they are. And so-and-so is a terrible teacher because they don't have this gift or whatever. That it's not about, I really believe now that it's not about a gift that you have or you don't have, because there are things that work and things that don't work, and you can learn them, and it's okay. They take time to learn, but you can do that. So, I wish I had known that when I first started out and was thinking about maybe going into a primarily teaching job. I think I removed myself out of a lot of opportunities because I was like, well, I'm just not a teacher.
Oh, yeah.
But it's about becoming one.
Oh, that's, yeah.
So there.
Man, it's a fucking process, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
The one thing that I learned about teaching, if you don't mind me piggybacking off that insight, is the number one criteria for being a good teacher is not intelligence. It's giving a shit. And if you're willing to learn new things and accept that you are going to be an imperfect vessel that will improve over time, the only people who can really absorb that lesson are people who give a shit, who care more about the task than about the ego.
Yeah.
Right on. And look at that. We find a way to end on a positive note. All right, guys.
It was not headed that way for a while.
No. I'll always hard right back into something that feels good. And so, all right, with that, thanks, guys. You guys have been the best. I super enjoyed this. If you guys ever want to be in a future episode, man, let us know. Like, we're all about it.
Oh, yeah, I'm 100% in.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Ready or not, here comes science. They might be trying, here comes science.